Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome back to our continuing series, Musings by Professor G. Venkatraman. Radio Sai now brings you a special talk by Professor G. Venkatraman. This talk was recorded on the 12th of December 2015, and here it is for your listening pleasure.
Loving pranams at the lotus feet, Sai Ram, and greetings from Prashanti Nilayam. Today I would like to reflect on the 34th convocation of Swami's Institute held recently. By His grace, I have been able to attend the annual convocation of the Institute for the 23rd time and without any break. During the time Swami was physically with us, there was, to my knowledge, only one outstanding scientist who was the guest of honor. That happened in the year of Swami's 60th birthday, i.e. in 1985. Following Mahasamadhi, the scenario has changed, and thereafter we have had a string of scientists and technologists as the chief guest, all of them Indians. By contrast, this year's guest of honor, Professor Kenjo Uchino, was from overseas. In addition to being a scientist cum technologist, Professor Uchino is also an entrepreneur and a government advisor. The distinguished professor initially spent many years in his homeland, Japan, and after about two decades he went to America, where he soon became a citizen. Currently, Professor Uchino shares time between Japan, the land of his birth, and America, the land of his adoption. Coming to Professor Uchino's convocation address, I could not hear his speech clearly from where I was seated. However, the moment he said that he was born in Hiroshima soon after the war, I sat up and tried hard to listen to the professor's speech, because I have been to Hiroshima and seen the amazing exhibition there that depicts clearly the horrors of a nuclear war. Since I was unable to properly listen to the speech live, I asked our studio to send me a copy of the audio and listen to it very carefully. I must say, Professor Uchino's speech was distinctly better than many I have heard in recent years. That is the reason I have decided to make the convocation address the starting point for this musing talk. Now, Professor Uchino is quite obviously blessed with limitless and intensive curiosity, which he has skillfully blended with an amazing propensity for learning. Add to this an American-style capacity for pushing aggressively forward, balanced by a Japanese-style capacity for patience while striving hard, and you get the multifaceted personality that Professor Uchino is. Thus, at one time, Professor Uchino was an active researcher, a teacher, an entrepreneur, and also a student in a business school, all at the same time. Wow, that is some multitasking. I was also fascinated by the fact that Professor Uchino's professional career has followed the evolution of Japan, as also of Japanese science and technology after World War II. In a sense, it reminded me of the many twists and turns in my own scientific career as India went from colonial rule to freedom and has been struggling hard ever since to pull herself out of abject poverty into modernity, striking a balance between economic process and poverty eradication. In the seven or so decades that followed independence, India has unquestionably made stupendous progress. That said, the fact remains that right now, 1/3 of all the poor people on planet Earth live in India. In other words, the road ahead for India is in no way smooth and easy. The question thus becomes, which is more important, economic growth or the total eradication of poverty? Can one sacrifice the former for the latter? If not, how does one strike a balance? This dilemma is faced not only by India, but many countries the world over, particularly in Africa. There is a widespread feeling, echoed also by Professor Uccino, that the only way out is via more technology. Having worked for several decades in both advanced science as also technology, I am not too sure that more science and technology alone can solve the problem. The point is that people who develop technology know very little about the tremendous problems faced by the poor on a day-to-day basis. And even if they do, they do not seem to be bothered. It is in this context that an important piece of advice given to us by Swami becomes very pertinent. Swami often told us that neither progeny nor wealth and fame can lead one to pure bliss or ananda, and that sacrifice alone can. Now, though Swami has said this umpteen times, hardly anyone takes it seriously. Even more important is the fact that Swami went far beyond oral advice to actually demonstrate that sacrifice can be made quietly and unobtrusively with hardly anyone noticing it. Arguably, that is the noblest form of sacrifice. Now, many are the examples one can give of how Swami went out of the way to give ananda to his devotees. But for today, I have chosen Swami's trip to Delhi and Simla by way of making my point. As a member of Swami's sizable party during that trip, I could see from close quarters what a huge demand that visit made on Swami's frail physical body. Swami was not the body, but he did carry a body, and that body did take punishment. Now, Delhi becomes very hot in summer, and people who can afford make a prompt getaway to escape the heat. And here was Bhagavan going to Delhi just to please the devotees there, as also all of us who were privileged to travel with him. The tour began with all of us flying by a chartered Airbus 320 straight from Puttaparthi to Delhi. Swami has made many visits to Delhi before, and during those trips, he invariably stayed in the house of his host. This time, Swami was visiting Delhi after a gap of 10 years, and for this trip, he made the Sri Satya Sai International Center his base. I should mention here that during his last visit to Delhi in 1999, Swami it was who had inaugurated this center. Even then, he had decided this center would be his residence during all his future visits to that metro city. Swami's daily schedule was tight and demanding, packed with darshans, house visits, and so on. I still remember one hot day when, starting in the morning, Swami had to visit a school and two houses, one after another, located in different parts of that huge metro, and everywhere he had to sit down for a meal. Can you imagine that? Apart from house visits, Swami had to give daily darshan at the International Center, and since not many could be admitted to that place, he also had to give two public darshans at a big ground quite some distance away. The public darshan, scheduled around sunset, was always an extended affair, what with cultural programs, speeches, etc. In the midst of all this, Bhagavan made sure to make a totally private visit that was not in the planned program. Hearing that former Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee was ailing and could not come for Swami's darshan at the International Center, Swami went to Vajpayee's residence instead. That being a very special and private visit, none of us went along with Swami, except those attending on him. Swami's relationship with Mr. Vajpayee goes way back to 1977, when the latter came to Whitefield to participate in the summer course conducted that year. Swami knew that had he been keeping well, Mr. Vajpayee surely would have come to the International Center, as did so many other VVIPs. You and I may see Swami's special house visit as an act of great kindness, which it surely was. However, at a much deeper level, it was a case of the Lord going to a devotee who was too sick to come to him, in order to sit by the devotee's bedside and shower grace via an intimate and personal conversation. Swami's stay on earth is full of such subtle shades of the human aspect of the avatar, the divine undercurrent of which eludes most of us for reasons both Krishna and Swami have explained. For the record, my recent birthday broadcast was all about Swami speaking about the Sri Satya Sai avatar, which he did way back in 1974. Getting back to the Delhi-Simla visit, after spending a few days in Delhi, Swami paid a brief 48-hour visit to the hill station Simla, nestling in the Himalayas. This was a welcome break since Simla was much cooler than Delhi. Besides, there were no house calls. All things considered, I have a feeling that Swami welcomed the brief Simla break. Here, I must not forget to mention that since Simla airport could not land anything except small air taxis, most of our party made the trip to Simla and back by bus, while a very small number were ferried across in two separate air taxis. The short trip over, Swami returned to Delhi to spend a day there before emplaning for Puttaparthi on the following day. While leaving Simla, Swami arrived in Delhi airport around noon, when the sun was blazing away fiercely. Adding to the problem, the air taxi that brought Swami could not go to the terminal building as big planes do. Instead, the taxi slowly crawled to the area designated for small private planes, which was quite far from the terminal building. Somehow, bearing the sweltering heat, Swami deplaned, got on the boiling tarmac and made his way to his car parked a short distance away. Even his physical condition at that time, how Bhagwan managed all that is still a mystery to me. Anyway, after a long drive, Swami reached the Sri Satya Sai International Center. Now, given the travel strain he had to bear, Swami should have taken complete rest in his room for the rest of the day. Instead, he joined us for evening tea, and as he looked around, Swami spotted an elderly gentleman whom he had personally picked for the trip. Swami asked this gentleman, "Have you been to Delhi before?" And the gentleman replied, "No, Swami." Bhagwan smiled and said, "Come, let us all go around Delhi a bit so that you can see the sights." Hurriedly, a convoy was formed, and sitting in our respective cars, we saw Delhi through the haze created by dust, even as the sun was setting. Here, Swami was playing a role similar to a worldly dad taking his children out for a drive. One example of the manner in which Swami went out of the way to make sure that all who came with him received loving and personal attention, blessing them in the process with eternal memories. Next morning after breakfast, the entire party flew back to Puttaparthi by a chartered Airbus. During the flight, the music boys in the party engaged Swami by spontaneously presenting an impromptu concert, complete with tabla and sitar. What a wonderful love fest it was between the Lord and his property, as he called his students, and at celestial heights. Let me now get back to the theme of sacrifice. Swami always assured his audiences that by asking devotees to sacrifice, he did not expect them to give up home and hearth, withdraw to the forest, etc. Reducing the concept to basic principles, Swami always asked, Can you not, in the course of your normal life, do something that makes others happy in such a manner that you also get some joy out of it? Given the prevailing philosophy of winners and losers, people invariably ask, how on earth is that possible? Swami's answer is simple. He says, whatever be your profession, can you not smile and be courteous when you speak to your colleagues? If you are a doctor, can you not treat the patient as a human being who needs help, rather than just another customer whom you have to dispose of quickly, so that you can deal with more patients and make more money? In modern lingo, that advice would translate as, can you not make the process of giving into a win-win game instead of a zero-sum game? Concerning asking and giving, President John Kennedy famously said in his inaugural address, and I quote, "And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country," end of quote. That was President Kennedy speaking in 1961. Swami, on the other hand, has been telling us for God knows how long that the essence of the many Puranas written by Sage Vyasa could be summarized in just one line, namely, Paropakaram Idam Sariram. Roughly translated, it means, God has given you this body with the exceptional human form so that you may serve others. It is to be noted in this context that the word others has to be interpreted in an all-inclusive sense rather than just as other people. This brings me to certain recent events where sacrifice assumes great importance, both in a societal as well as a global context. I am referring in particular to the ongoing Paris Conference on Climate Change. I am sure that at least some listeners might have heard about the animated discussions taking place there. Everyone gathered in Paris is agreed that currently humans are burning too much fossil fuel, in particular coal, which pumps billions of tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere every year, triggering thereby man-made climate change. Presently, things have almost reached a tipping point, and one simply cannot afford to pollute the atmosphere any further. In other words, the burning of fossil fuels must be phased out immediately. And that precisely is where there is a huge divide between the developed countries on the one hand and countries like India on the other that are yet to progress, quote-unquote, and join the club of developed nations, quote-unquote. Where India is concerned, it has over 300 million poor people who have absolutely no access whatsoever to electricity. This is the largest number of poor people in any country. And their lot has to be improved. If their lot is to be improved, then clearly India has to generate massive amounts of electricity, which can be done only by burning huge amounts of coal. And that, of course, would be detrimental to the whole planet. India's dilemma is thus this. Should it focus on development, which basically helps people in the upper bracket to make more money and not bother about uplifting the poor? Or should it improve the lot of the poor by giving a much lower priority to capital growth? Indeed, the issue of poverty crops up in a large number of issues, be it social, economic, healthcare, or whatever, especially when it is related to an entire country, a region of the globe, or even the whole world. Let me now sharply change gear and consider instead how to deal with all man-made problems, like climate change, for example, by going straight to the basics. In today's world, economic growth basically helps the well-to-do to become wealthier, a process which necessarily disadvantages the poor. Is that really correct and moral? Keeping the question just posed in mind, let us recall what Swami said when he came earlier as Lord Sri Krishna. In just two short slokas, the Lord then said to Arjuna, of course, Desire is the wise man's eternal foe, O Kaunteya, and is like an insatiable fire. The senses and the mind are its lurking places. Through these agents, desire smothers wisdom and deludes the embodied Atman. For the record, these are slokas 3.39 and 3.40 of the Gita. Swami gave the same advice to us, but in slightly different words. He simply said that all of us, without exception, must make ceiling on desires our topmost priority. Swami did not give us that advice just for saving the planet. His view was far more basic and fundamental. Swami's point was that as aspects of the divine, the humanness latent in us with human form would shine only when we give up worldly desires and yearn instead to serve every single entity in creation by whatever means possible, even while we see God in everything, everywhere, and all the time. Have we ever spent even a single minute pondering along those lines? Please think about it. Thank you for listening. God bless, and Jai Sai Ram.
Sai Ram, dear listeners, till now you were listening to a special musings talk by Professor G. Venkatraman. This talk was recorded on the 12th of December, 2015. Dear listener, your feedback is valuable to us. You may write to listener@radiosci.org. Thank you and Sai Ram.